Okay, so we're. Where is that? What? Oh, I know why. I know why. Forgot to do that. Why is it doing that? It's kind of weird. Let's try this again. So I believe we got all the way through to viruses, herpes. We finished herpes. Right, so that's where we are. So the fourth type of it is, people don't think of it as being mononucleosis as being in the Varicella-Zoster group, but in fact it is. It's most commonly associated with something called Epstein-Barr, and because Epstein-Barr is associated with mononucleosis, and that Epstein-Barr is a member of the herpes virus family, then therefore that's how they associate the two together because of that relationship. Usually, young adults and children, do you know what it used to be called? The kissing disease, right? Because it was thought that, through mucous membranes and kissing, it would pass that way. In children so mild, it usually is attributed to nonspecific illnesses. In fact, a lot of people, when they get mononucleosis, usually just are unwell and don't think much of it, and the virus passes and they go on with their lives. 95% of people between 35 and 40 years have been infected with this Epstein-Barr virus. So it actually, most of us get it. We just know some get it really badly and they're sick for quite a long time. Others don't. 30 to 50% of the time, an adolescent or young adult who is infected with this Epstein-Barr virus will develop the symptoms of infectious mononucleosis. So what happens is you can get an initial Epstein-Barr virus, and it'll stay that way, and you'll get rid of the virus, and you'll be fine, and you'll be done. But occasionally, it moves into mononucleosis, which of course is the form of this. Transmission is through contact with oral secretions, blood, or transplanted organs with the virus. As I said, used to be called the kissing disease. So what's it look like? You get significant lymphedema, so swollen lymph glands in the and you see this within the lymph nodes and spleen, but you also get lymphoid proliferation in the blood, lymph nodes, and spleen. In other words, it really stimulates the immune response to react to when you're sick with this. It produces fever, sore throat, tender cervical lymphadenopathy, so sore in the cervical region of the lymph nodes, headache, malaise, and abdominal pain from something called splenomegaly. And splenomegaly, of course, megaly stands for growth or large. So in the case of this, when you're sick with this, your spleen can actually enlarge because of inflammation. In some cases, 2 to 3 times its normal size. So the physician will palpate underneath the left rib cage, because if you do have splenomegaly, it will be a firm sort of feeling under, just popping up from underneath that left side of the rib cage. You can also get a bit of hepatitis with it as well. I'm remembering, the term hepatitis just simply means inflammation of the liver. Right? Incubation generally between 4 to 6 weeks. You do get temperature fluctuations throughout the day. You do see an increase in white blood cell counts, so meaning the temperature can go up and down. If you do have splenomegaly, you find pain in the upper left quadrant, and if it's bad enough, the referral pain from an inflamed spleen can refer pain to the left shoulder and the left upper trapezius, which, kind of is part of what we need to think about in case someone comes to us with, discomfort in those sorts of areas. 1 to 5% of folks who get this can involve the central nervous system, which can sometimes include something called Guillain-Barré syndrome. I don't think you've come across that before. It actually affects motor neurons, and you get minor paralysis that usually resolves after a short period of time. That's a little bit later. That'll probably be within your neurophysiology or pathology at the time. Encephalitis, of course, which is brain swelling, aseptic meningitis, so the meninges are the coverings of the brain or the spinal cord. Those can get inflamed, usually more in the brain. Peripheral neuritis and inflamed peripheral nerves, and optic neuritis, so pain with the optic nerve as well and inflammation. So, but very, very small percentage, 1 to 5%. Symptoms reside basically 6 to 10 days after onset, but in some cases, symptoms can persist for weeks. Usually, those acute symptoms of this inflammation, fever, those sorts of things, they generally tend to resolve anywhere within a month after the onset of the disease, but fatigue and lymphadenopathy can persist longer. So the patient can express being very, very tired and fatigued for months afterwards, as well as these swollen lymph nodes.
Prognosis is excellent with rest and supportive care, and in most cases, everybody after 2 to 3 months pretty much results back to normal function, and they're fine with it. So you can see here we've got, you know, the lymph chain here is all swollen up just under the in the chin area and underneath. We see here we can get again, your tonsils are actually lymph tissue, so you'll actually get them swelling up, lymphadenopathies here as well with it, because they'll express a sore throat, and you'll see this, and you can see just in terms of where the normal size of the spleen is compared to a splenomegaly, where it will actually pop out underneath that left lower rib cage, and the physician can somewhat palpate for it. Warts is another viral infection. They're common, they're benign, and they tend to affect either skin or mucosa, and they are caused by the human papillomavirus. And there are a number of them that you can have. Transmission is likely through contact, but if you have a wart on one finger and you touch the other hand, you can inoculate the other side as well, so you can actually infect yourself in different places. Now, they can appear as a single wart onto its own, but they also can appear as multiple, sort of like a cluster of them, and they'll cover a large area. They usually have a fairly thick white surface, tends to be white in nature, almost looks like a callus, and they can have horn-like projections that come out of it, extensions. Verruca vulgaris is the most common form, and this appears as a rough, elevated, round surface, most frequently found on the extremities, especially the hands and fingers. So we can see here where, you know, you've got this circle with this roughened top on it. Now this kind of represents this verruca vulgaris. We can see it here and here. Have you ever had them? You ever had a wart as a kid? Yeah, many of us do, especially when we're younger. And they're not uncommon at all. When we find warts on the feet, because they tend to be on the plantar surface, of course, then they are called plantar warts. And they are not quite as elevated as the vulgaris type, generally more flat. They can appear singly, but more often they form in groups, especially where there's pressure points on the foot. So we can see here that they've all come together sort of at the head of the second and third metatarsal here. Same as here again, between the second and third metatarsal, and you can see they kind of spread a little bit more of it. My daughter one time did have them, and they counted 30. She had 30 particular plantar warts on her foot. Yeah. Some warts respond to simple treatment, others spontaneously disappear. You have to remember, warts are a virus. And if we have a really good, strong immune system, there's no reason why your internal immune system couldn't kill off the wart, right? It can happen. Sometimes when people get chronic warts, it can give the medical practitioner the impression that possibly the individual's immune system's not working as well as it could. So sometimes they'll look at that from that point of view, not in a serious sense, like a serious disease, but just that maybe the immune system's a little bit depressed. Choice of treatment is influenced by location, size and number, presence of secondary, amount of tenderness on palpation, age and gender, history of previous treatment, and patient choice. We don't see it quite as often anymore, but some time ago, it was not uncommon for them to take a scalpel, freeze the area, take a scalpel, and actually scoop it out. But now, one of the treatments is, of course, salicylic acid. So that's your preparation W or whatever it is for warts. You know, it's a little fluid that you put on every morning. It's basically salicylic acid. You can use electrodesiccation and curettage, and the use of cryotherapy, laser therapy, and chemical cautery can also be used to treat. So you can either electrify it and burn it and then scoop it, or you can use cryotherapy, which is liquid nitrogen, which is probably the most common treatment used for warts nowadays, where they'll just take a bit of a wand that's on the end of the liquid nitrogen tank, and you sort of push a valve, and the liquid nitrogen fills in the end of the tip, and it gets extremely cold. If they touch the wart with it, which takes the wart down to, you know, minus whatever liquid nitrogen is, kills the cells within the wart, and then the wart just kind of disappears afterwards. When my daughter had her 30 warts on her foot, I was a little concerned that they were going to have to go in and, you know, scoop a fair amount of tissue out. She went and saw a dermatologist, And the dermatologist recommended something, and we thought it was quite odd, but it worked like a charm. We had to buy an aloe vera plant. We had to use like an emery board to take the rough, soak the foot and take the rough top off. And then we had to cut open the leaf of the aloe vera plant, exposing the gel, lay it down on top of the warts, tape it down, put a sock on, and she'd go to bed like that every night. And within about 3 weeks, the warts were all gone. Thought it was kind of a cool way to do it. Next are fungal infections. So we've done viral infections. Now we're doing fungal. One of the most common is called ringworm, also known as Tinea corporis. And dermatophytosis, or fungal infections of the hair, skin, or nails, are designated by the Latin term tinea, hence the reason it comes from. So if we have skin kind of fungal infections that involve the hair, skin, or nails, the term always starts with the term tinea and then afterwards. Now, when we look at ringworm, that there is no worm here. There's no worm in a ringworm infection. It's the way it looks that gives the impression that there is a worm. You get a curling at the edges of the circle that gives you the impression there might be a worm lying at the outer borders of this fungal infection. So we say it has no association with worms, but due to its presence of the formation of ring-shaped pigmented patches covered with vesicles or scales, and that often come itchy. So it's because it's this formation that gives them that impression that there might be a worm there. The ring does expand outward. It does expand in that circle, continues through, and it can get large enough that the center of the circle, the fungal infection is done, and the skin can return back to normal. Usually it occurs, that transmission occurs directly through close contact with infected people or animals, or indirectly through contaminated objects such as shoes, towels, or shower stalls. I have had ringworm. I got it 1 year. A farmer put down one of his animals and brought it into my dad's butcher shop, and I guess there was a bit of the fungus on maybe a bit of hide left on the animal when he brought it in, because the animal was skinned when we got it, but there might have been a bit there, and I ended up getting it on my forearm. I guess I had touched the area when the meat came in, and I had it treated with antifungal cream at the time, and it was fine. Lesions worsen in warm, moist environments, and the treatments requires maintaining clean, dry skin and applying an antifungal powder or topical type of cream, fungal cream, antifungal cream. They'll get rid of it. Mine didn't spread throughout too much. I just had basically one lesion on my forearm, kind of looked like this. And it was pretty obvious at first because we didn't know what it was and never seen it before. I went to the physician, and, you know, they took one look at it and said, oh, you got ringworm, you know, and then figured it must have gotten it from this animal that the farmer had brought in. The next is called, we know it as athlete's foot. Remember, because it involves skin, tinea is the Latin term for it. And, of course, because it's in the foot, we use the Latin term pedis, which basically means foot. This causes erythema, skin peeling, and pruritus. Remember, it's itching between toes that may spread from interdigital spaces to the plantar surface of the foot. So quite often we see it here in the interdigital spaces, lying sort of like this. This is the more common area because in there it's a bit moist, it's warm, and that's why you can kind of hang out there and it's okay. You can get severe infection that can result in inflammation because you're scratching it and it's painful, and then you break the skin and you can start a secondary infection. You can get an odor from it because, again, it's, you know, it increases the moisture and you get associated bacteria and so on and so forth. Clean, dry socks and adequate wood footwear are important. And, of course, washing the feet and drying thoroughly between the toes using an antifungal cream or powder can be applied. One of the common areas you can get this is in public showers. So if you're an athlete and you shower in with the teams or where teams always go, you have a higher possibility of getting it because obviously it's moist in there and wet on the floor and the fungus can kind of hang around there. The odd thing is, I mean, for all the years I played sports and went in showers and I never wore shower shoes, I've never had this. Not ever, but you will see people will wear shower shoes. I don't know if you wear them when you go in. You wear like a shower shoe? Yeah. You know, you get them even in campsites where there's, you know, common bathrooms where you can use it as well. Yeast infections, also known as candidiasis. This is where we end up with an overgrowth of yeast rather than fungus. So this results from an overpopulation of normally occurring yeast in chronically wet or moist areas.
Yeast infections of the skin are frequently a complication of moisture-associated skin damage, known as MASD. And when we get into pressure sores from people in long-term care or long-standing diaper wear, you know, you get people in long-term facilities and they're in wet diapers for extended periods of time, one of the things that happens is it's so moist because the diaper's wet, the skin starts to break down because they're in this constant wet environment, and then you get an opportunistic yeast infection that can occur in the area where the skin has been wet for extended periods of time. And so yeast infections of the skin are frequently a complication of moisture-associated skin damage as a result of wound exudate, urine, stool, and or perspiration. So anywhere you have skin that's wet for extended periods of time, whether that be urine or a weepy sore or whatever, then you start to have this damage associated with moisture, and then you can get an opportunistic yeast infection that can happen. Therefore, MASD can be found in peri-wound skin, peristomal skin, so skin around a stoma where they've created a hole like for a colostomy, in skin folds with incontinence and associated dermatitis. So again, you get people who are extremely obese and you get skin flaps and, you know, where skin comes together and air can't get in there and it's moist. Quite often you'll open the two parts and expose them and you'll see there's usually a pretty significant yeast infection kind of occurring in that dark wet area. It usually appears as a bright red rash with tiny macules and papules, but can also appear scaly. So you can get them in your mouth, right? You can get yeast infection in the mouth. Which, what do we call that? Do you know what yeast infection in the mouth is? So obviously it's in other areas of yeast infection. When we look at it in the mouth, it's called, it just disappeared. I'll bring it back. It'll come back to me. I can't believe it's gone. But you can get them in the mouth, no different than, you know, a female can get them in the vaginal environment and that kind of stuff. You can also get it, you can see around the face here. This is sort of a little bit of yeast infection here. Thrush. It's called thrush. I knew it would come to me eventually. Yeah, so a yeast infection in the mouth is known as thrush. Now, scabies is something we need to be very particularly aware of. Scabies are highly infectious. And so it's a highly contagious skin eruption caused by a mite bite. So mites, usually, you know, obviously if we have mites, usually where we have more poverty, not as clean and so forth. We've had one or two scabies outbreaks in the clinic downstairs because someone comes in and they have them, and then you got to go for a full disinfection because they are so contagious. So the female bite burrows into the skin and deposits eggs that hatch into larvae in a few days. So it's out there because there's an estimated prevalence of 130 million cases worldwide at any given time. So they're out there, and again, associated with poverty and uncleanliness and not able to wash appropriately and so forth. Early transmitted by skin-to-skin contact or by contact with contaminated objects such as linens or shared inanimate objects. So we have a patient come in the clinic. They have scabies. We put them on the table. They're covered in the sheets. Those sheets can infect you just as much as touching the area of the patient as well. So we have to be very cognizant of it. Mites can spread rapidly between members of the same household, nursing homes, or institutions. You end up with an inflammatory response and itching about 2 to 6 weeks after initial contact. So that means you could be infected with mites for at least 2 to 6 weeks and be walking around like there's nothing wrong, spreading the mites and not realize that you're infected with it until you start to show the signs. Symptoms include intense pruritus, so really bad scratching at night, excoriated skin, so skin like peeling off, and one or more burrows. It looks like a linear ridge with a vesicle at one end. So you can actually see where the female mite kind of dug into your skin and is crawling along to lay their eggs. Nice thought, huh? The mite is usually found in a burrow, which is commonly found in the interdigital spaces, flexor aspects of the wrists, into the axilla, waistline, nipples in females, which seems kind of like, imagine, genitalia in males, and the umbilicus region. So, you know, they tend to like their spots in the body, and as I said, 2 to 6 weeks, they don't even know they're infected. That's why, you know, they could be in the clinic. You may have treated them, nothing seemed wrong, and then all of a sudden you hear a week later they had scabies, then we've got a bit of a 911, we got to disinfect and
You got to check yourself and all those sorts of things. Itching can lead to the breakdown of skin and possibly secondary infections. And to treat, you traditionally use a scabicide, which is usually a lotion or cream that contains a chemical called permethrin or lindane as applied from neck to feet. So you literally have to cover your whole body to try to take these mites away. The second one is Lyme disease. Of course, we all hear about Lyme disease and it's associated with, right. So it's an infectious multisystemic disorder caused by ticks infected with the spirochete. The reason it's called Lyme disease because it was first discovered in Lyme, Connecticut in 1976. Kind of crazy. Just discovered, that's not very long ago to discover a new disease. The fact that the tick was the vector of this disease was not discovered until 1982. It's transmitted only by certain ticks in North America, known as the deer or black-legged tick in the northeast and central, and the western black-legged tick on the west coast. So we can see here, just for example, in Ontario, how significantly now we're finding ticks in Ontario, and this was in 2019, so this is 3 years old, 4 years old, and at this point, I believe this is much larger because they're finding ticks more and more all over the place. It has become the most prevalent vector-borne disease in North America, especially in the U.S., and most cases have been reported from the Mid-Atlantic and seen into, so Mid-Atlantic is kind of the common place, and generally tend to see signs of this late summer, from spring to summer, like it's, you know, runs all the way till even now in some cases. The infection is spread when a tick nymph seeks a blood meal by waiting on the underside of shrubs or grass. So you walk by, your arm or leg, you're wearing a pair of shorts, rubs the underside of the grass, the tick grabs onto you, and then has a chance to start to burrow. But here's what's interesting. The tick needs more than 36 hours or more of feeding before the spirochetes, which is a form of bacteria, move to the salivary gland of the tick and then into the host. So that tick has to be burrowed into you and feeding on you for 36 hours before you potentially get infected with Lyme disease. Right? This is why, you know, we want to keep an eye on the fact that we have ticks are there. We want to look for the bite site, which we'll talk about in a second, has a very particular look to it. And then, you know, that starts happening again, that tick's been there for 36 hours. So, you know, it's always recommended a walk in the bush. Should, you know, be, if you're with someone, look at each other, top to bottom, back to front, all the way around, and see if there's a tick lying around. Once, if they're there 36 hours and these spirochetes do get into the blood, then they, so the tick needs more than 36 hours or more of feeding before the spirochetes move to the salivary gland of the tick and then into the host. The spirochete for 3 to 32 days have to be around sort of in the blood for 3 to 32 days, and then it will result in an inflammatory response resulting in this skin lesion at the site of the bite. So we're talking a fair amount of time here, right? We've got a tick that's been on your body for 36 hours, we get the release of the spirochete into the bloodstream, into the bite site, and then anywhere from 3 days to 32 days, you don't even start to see this. So that's your classic bite that could lead to Lyme disease from a tick. And that takes anywhere from 3 to 36 days after the spirochete's gone in. The bacteria, once there, then disseminates into other organs via lymph or lymphatics. And then, of course, this then starts to stimulate an immune response, which you start getting cytokines and antibodies. And that's why the bite site starts looking red, because you're getting a histamine response, cytokine response, and so forth at the site. So one thing about Lyme disease, it can manifest in quite a diversity of signs and symptoms. And sometimes your very first bite, you don't get any symptoms at all, or you can get symptoms for up to a month after the bite. So you may see the bite site, but you're not going to notice any of these other symptoms for quite a period of time. So stage one, generally between 4 and 14 days, it stays localized. 80% have a red, slowly expanding rash called erythema migrans, this bullseye appearance, but not everybody gets the rash. But this is a classic sign that happens quite often, and it does take 4 to 14 days before that rash starts to appear. Within 4 weeks, that rash disappears, and just on its own, it's gone. As a result of this early dissemination, flu-like symptoms can occur. So at this time in stage one, you can start to feel fatigued, have chills, fever, headache, feel really tired and lethargic. You can get myalgias, which is muscle pain, and arthralgias, which is joint pain. That can start to associate in stage one. In stage two, you get what's called disseminated infection. So you can have the skin, the nervous system, hearts, and joints now infected in this stage two. In skin, you start to see multiple smaller erythema migraines over days and weeks after infection. So you'll start to see, if we go back to this one here, you can see, you know, this doesn't necessarily mean that this individual was bitten by three mites. It could be they were bitten by the initial one, but now because it's in the bloodstream, those circles are starting to show up in other places in the body because it's been around for long enough. Neurologic symptoms occur within weeks to months after the initial infection and maybe the first symptom. So you may end up with aseptic meningitis, which of course is inflammation of the skins around the nervous system, with mild headache, stiff neck, and difficulty with mentation, in other words, thinking. You can also get what are called cranial neuropathies, such as Bell's palsy, where you're the side of your face and actually becomes paralyzed, and you have dropping of the eye or the lip. And you can also have radiculopathies, which are issues with pain and dysfunction distal to where the nerve is, traveling wherever that nerve innervates. A classic triad is lymphocytic meningitis, facial nerve palsy, and radiculoneuritis. So you get inflamed nerves. You get this facial nerve palsy, which means basically a paralyzed face that droops, and lymphocytic meningitis, the skin around the brain and or spinal cord starts to get inflamed and it's painful. 5% of people who get this far into the infection experience cardiac signs and symptoms, such as ECG changes when they're looked at, dysrhythmias, so suddenly they get irregular heartbeats, very rapid or slow pulses, they feel dizzy, they have fainting, chest pain, and shortness of breath. So, you know, it can get into this, you can see fairly systemic problems with it. Symptoms resolve after several days to weeks, and some may experience migratory arthralgias, but not arthritis during this stage. So they don't have inflamed joints, but they have sore joints, and that can go anywhere in the body. So here we have a tick that's just hanging out, not doing anything. And here we have a tick that's what they do. They embed their head into the skin, and then they start to blood feed, right? And you can see how they can start this small, and after a good 36 hours of feeding, they're quite large. So you can tell how they would be very difficult to see on someone. You wouldn't even know it was there initially. And that's just why that, you know, they could actually just hang out there and eat for 36 hours and you wouldn't even know you had a tick in the area. Now, if we get to stage three, this is what's called late persistent infection. So stage three can start showing up months to years after the initial infection. And now we really start involving joints and nervous system can start getting involved significantly. This is usually stage three tends to occur if this disease is left untreated. 60% who are left untreated develop stage three joint symptoms. So they get intermittent or chronic monoarticular or oculoarticular arthritis. So now they're getting, instead of just joint pain, they're getting joint inflammation. So they're starting to show signs of synovitis and other structures are starting to become inflamed. You're getting an actual immune response in the joint itself. When we look at monoarticular, we're saying one joint, oligoarticular, many joints. So you all of a sudden start to see a joint not only inflamed, but it's starting to swell up. It looks very large and it's swollen. It suggests that early treatment can avoid this. Sorry. Late onset, you get neurological disease that can consist of chronic axonal polyneuropathies with spinal radicular pain or distal paresthesias. So you'll actually start to see referred pain or numbness distal to, because it started to affect the spinal, close to the spinal cord. Post-infection syndromes. So first is post-Lyme disease syndrome. Very similar to fibromyalgia. So, you know, pain in certain spots that are chronic, very, very sensitive to touch, can shift and move around, those sorts of things. Some people can actually get what's called chronic Lyme disease, and this is possibly the bacteria triggering a neurohormonal or immunological process that causes these symptoms. So the thing to take away is there's three stages. Treatment is to try to prevent going into stage two, and definitely trying not to go into stage three, because then of course they can get into all these sorts of problems. It starts to involve the joints and the nervous system and so forth. Management, of course, prevention is the key. The other thing is that once a tick has been seen and known to have bitten an individual and started to blood feed, then within 72 hours, you need to be treated. You need to start being treated, which of course prevents it from getting into, hopefully, into the stage two, and definitely, hopefully, not getting into stage three. They usually put you on oral antibiotics for 14 days. And of course, in some cases, treatments focus on the specific symptoms. So, you know, depending on what's going on, they'll treat accordingly. But for most, Lyme disease is curable with standard antibiotic therapies at any of the stages, and then you're fine and good to go. What's interesting, though, is you get this bite, you get an immune response, you get, you know, arthralgias and arthritis and so forth, but there's no immunity created. So you can get bit again and get infected again. There's no immunity to it. There was a gentleman, he's still in a winemaking company down in Toronto. What was the name of their wine company? He's Canadian. They make wines. He's Italian. Famous wine guy. Had a very successful wine company, and he got Lyme disease, and it killed him in his 40s. Yeah, it was not didn't do well for him. He didn't do well with it. Okay, next. Where are you? See if we can finish this one, and then we'll kind of decide what we want to do. So we're going to continue with pathologies. Now we're going to get into skin cancer. Okay, so we've left bacterial infections, we left viral infections, fungal infections, and so forth. Now we have to talk about skin cancer. Skin cancer is the most common form of cancer in the United States and is steadily increasing in Canada. Lung, colorectal, and pancreatic are 1, 2, and 3 accordingly. And then, of course, skin cancer is starting to catch up. Solar radiation is believed to be the major cause. So, of course, sunburns, you know, being exposure to the sun for long periods of time increase our risk for skin cancer. Protection from the sun in the first 2 decades significantly reduces the risk of skin cancer. So people of my age group have a much higher risk of skin cancer because, you know, up until my 20s, when I went to high school, it was really common to cover yourself in baby oil and deliberately fry yourself in the sun. So our generation, my generation, we're at greater risk here because of this. Melanoma is rising, but not at the rate of many other countries. So it is starting to show up more and more here in North America. So when we look at skin cancer, we look at 3 categories. Benign issues with the skin, pre-malignant, and then, of course, cancer malignancies, meaning melanoma or non-melanoma. So we can see here on the chart, when we look at cancers with the Government of Canada in 2022, we can see down here melanoma. I kind of underlined it. And we can say that, you know, males in 2022, 2,300 cases, 380 died. In females, there were 1,850 cases, 190 died. For an overall, in 2022, 4,150 individuals got melanoma and 570 died. And so it's not an absolute death sentence, but we still want to see better numbers than that. And surprisingly enough, for most people, they don't realize this, number one with a bullet in Canada is bladder cancer. Crazy, eh? I think it wasn't bladder cancer. It was lung and bronchus cancers is high up, and the same as prostate. So you can see here in terms of lung and bronchus, 10,300. In terms of prostate, 10,200. So those, and then breast cancer, look at that, 11,310. So obviously that's getting up to being number one in Canada. So let's do benign lesions first. So the first is called seborrheic keratosis. It is a benign neoplasm formed through the proliferation of keratinocytes. Do you remember where we find keratinocytes? No. Do you remember when we looked at skin? Because keratinocytes do what? Okay, they're the ones that become our overall skin. So they start in the basal, in the deepest part of skin, they start alive. And remember, as they migrate up apically, they become more and more full of keratin, and then they start losing their organelles and their nucleus, so that by the time, because your keratinocytes, that keratinocytes are what make up your apical surface of your skin, by the time they get to the top of the apical surface, they're completely filled with keratin and they're dead. So the C cells that we're talking about, they're the ones that are always growing up to replace our skin from the basement membrane area, or from the epidermal dermal area. And so as the benign neoplasm forms through the proliferation of keratinocytes, occurs most so frequently after the middle age and can appear on the chest, back, and face. Often it appears during hormonal therapy or inflammatory dermatosis. The area is said to be waxy, smooth, or raised lesions that vary in color from flesh tones to dark brown or black, and may have a almost like a stuck-on appearance. It looks like somebody kind of stuck this thing on the skin itself. It can be sizes from barely palpable to very large verrucous or wart-like plaques. Usually they're left, when they're left untreated, they don't do much with them unless they become overly irritated and painful for the patient, then they will remove them. Liquid nitrogen is your typical treatment, so they just literally, like they did with the wart, they just put liquid nitrogen on it, it breaks it down and stops it, and then usually good to go. So we can see here, we can see the seborrheic keratosis here. I don't know if you know anybody who sort of has this sort of thing. Maybe your grandparents kind of had this type of facial thing going. Probably seen it. Yeah. Yep. So you can see it kind of raises up, right? The next is known as nevi or moles. We all call them as moles. They're benign pigmented or non-pigmented skin tumors. They form from aggregations of melanocytes that begin early in life. So melanocytes come together, and where they kind of congregate results in what we see as a mole. Most are brown, black, or flesh-colored and can appear in any part of the skin. And, of course, they can vary in size and thickness, and they can occur singly, or they can also occur in groups. They rarely transition to melanoma, but when malignant melanoma occurs, it often arises from a pre-existing mole. So moles rarely transition to melanoma, but when we do find melanoma, we usually know that it arises from a mole that was already there. So increased moles equals increased risk for melanoma. So if you have a moly person, or know one, they have an increased risk for melanoma just simply because they have more moles than usual. And certain cultural areas, environments they're in, some people's tend to be more moly than other people's. Consistent irritation of a mole can also increase the risk of melanoma. So, you know, if you're finding it itching and scratching, especially in females, may have a large mole, and where the bra strap sits, whether over the shoulder or around the thorax, you can have a mole under there that can be constantly irritated by something like the bra, and they'll remove the mole because, again, you have an irritated mole, you increase melanoma. For our purposes, you know, we see a mole, any change in size, color, or texture, bleeding, or excessive itching should be reported. Now, we have to remember, when's the last time you looked at your back from the perspective of looking to see if you had any unusual moles or anything? It's pretty rare. But what do we see every day in our patients? Their back. So this is why this is important to kind of understand, because you may see something in your patient at any given time where you might say, "Hey, you might want to go and see the doctor about this mole that you've got on your back." So here we can see dark moles, skin tags, light moles, and so forth, you know, like this. This is what melanoma does. It roots underneath and it digs. And so surgically, to remove it, sometimes they have to take that much out just to get rid of it. Yeah, because it just starts to, it literally digs underneath and moves out under the skin where it grows. When, how long ago was she diagnosed? Gotta love mums, eh? Okay. Oh, okay. Was she a sun worshiper back in her day? Was she? Okay. So benign lesions, then, of course, are seborrheic keratosis and moles. Our next ones are premalignant lesions. So these are lesions that can become cancerous. The first is called actinic keratosis, also known as solar keratosis. It is a skin neoplasm resulting from many years of UV rays. So someone who is outside all the time, a fisherman, a golfer, someone who runs tries, that kind of stuff, because they're exposed quite often to the sun, they have a little more risk to getting this. What happens is the damage from the overexposure, so the constant UV ray exposure, results in abnormal cell growth, which results in well-defined crusty or sandpaper-like patch or bump in the areas of overexposure. You can get this in the face, ears, lower lip, bald spot, bald scalp, you know, someone who's like in the lake all the time but they don't wear a hat, dorsal of the hands or forearms. And I don't know if you can see it, but I have this right there. Can you see where it's kind of red and crusty? You see that? That's what this is. Okay, so this is my many years of playing golf, being out, all those sorts of things. The base of the lesion can be light or dark, tan, pink, red, or a combination of these, or it can actually be the same color as the skin. The scale or crust is horny, dry, and rough, and that's what it is for me. When I touch it, that's what got me to the doctor about it, because I just started to feel, I could feel it when I was, you know, shaving and putting on a cream or something, and I just had it looked at like 3 weeks ago. They develop slowly, reaching about 3 to 6 millimeters in size. They're most common in light-skinned with blue, gray, or green eyes and red or blonde hair, because I was a redhead as well. Known risk of malignant degeneration and subsequent metastatic potential in neglected lesions. So that's what I was told by the physician. I'm taking like a cortisone cream. If that doesn't work, then I have to have it treated further, because it does have the potential, if not treated, to become cancerous eventually. Common treatment is liquid nitrogen, curettage, electrodissection, or topical creams. So right now I'm trying the cream. If that doesn't work, then she's going to have to use liquid nitrogen and burn it. So you can see it here in the hands, on the top of the head here. Mine don't get quite this bad, but this summer I did note when I was in the sun playing golf, it would really start to get white and crusty, and not to this degree, but it was still there as far as that went. The next is called Bowen disease. Again, we're still in premalignant lesions. Bowen disease is a non-melanoma group of skin cancers typically associated with long-term sun exposure, chemical exposure, which is arsenic, or HPV, which is human papillomavirus, which is warts, right? Lesions are persistently black, brown, or reddish brown. They have a scaly plaque with well-defined margins. Found most frequently in fair-skinned men older than 50, the treatments for Bowen disease is similar to actinic keratosis. It is somewhat rare, but if they do become cancerous, they're quite invasive and they do metastasize. So we can see them here, you know, pretty significantly. Can get quite thick and large. Kind of see it here in the breast tissue here of this picture, sort of opening up. So again, you know, it's persistent black, brown, or reddish brown scaly plaque. It has very well-defined margins. You can see it here. This is a pretty extreme case, but it happens. This is sort of showing beginning where it was, and I think this individual was probably treated maybe with liquid nitrogen or something like that, and that's the after left of it. So malignant non-melanoma carcinomas. So there are types of cancer that are not melanoma. Melanoma is considered to be the dangerous, most dangerous skin cancer, but you can get other types of mutations, cells of skin that is not melanoma. Okay. The first is called basal cell carcinoma. This is a slow-growing surface epithelium skin tumor that originates from undifferentiated basal cells in the epidermis. Remember we had, keratinocytes, but we had a layer that those grew out of. It's undifferentiated, right, as the skin grows. This is occurring down here in that basilar layer of the epidermis, right where the epidermis almost meets the dermis. Okay, so we're talking about the cells down in there. It rarely metastasizes beyond the skin and does not invade blood or lymph vessels. If it is left untreated, it can cause significant local destruction and may invade local subcutaneous tissue and bone, which means you'd have to dig that all out if it was left to get bad enough. It's the most common, and cases are rising. It is linked to increased and early age exposure to UV rays, by outdoor activities and indoor tanning. This is why indoor tanning is such a bad, bad thing, right? I don't know if it's as popular now as it used to be. I don't think it is either. You don't see as many places anymore. I don't think people, you know, I did know friends, they would do it in short term if they were going, if it was the middle of winter and they're going down south for a vacation in the islands. They just didn't want to walk out and expose themselves to sun without anything because they're afraid they might get more easily burned. It was previously only seen in blonde, fair-skinned men, and that's changing to include younger adults and women, and sun exposure is most common. Light skin, higher risk. Caucasians, over 23 to 40% risk of getting basal cell carcinoma. UV exposure results in DNA mutations, gene deactivation, and dysregulation of certain proteins in the skin. So you're actually affecting the skin cells and its DNA in order to regulate itself and proliferate properly and that kind of stuff. Typically, what results is a pearly or white appearance. There are rolled edges to the lesion. It is slightly elevated above the skin with small blood vessels on the surface. So you can kind of see it here. Right? It's kind of covering the whole area. When you have it, it'll tend to look as pink or red flat area, similar to what we see here at the top, and then it starts to progress accordingly. Okay? The nodule is painless. Oh, sorry, it can appear similar to squamous cell carcinoma, which we'll talk about here next. The nodule is painless and slowly increases in size and can ulcerate centrally. And that's what this little scab is here. That's an ulceration. And you can see, if left untreated, just how much it can invade and do damage to. 69% of cases are found on the head and neck, of course, because that's usually what's most exposed to sun, you know, in our day-to-day life, especially in North America. And treatment is influenced by the size, location, and depth. And you, at times, they may have to go in and surgically excise the tissues here that are cancerous. And of course, prognosis depends on when the intervention is used, and the longer, the more likelihood of disfigurement. And that's what's happened here. This has been cut away. So this was all probably looking similar to this, but on a larger scale. And this has all been surgically removed. The next is squamous cell carcinoma. It is the second most type of skin cancer. And this is a tumor of the epidermal keratinocytes that occurs most frequently in light-skinned individuals. So basal cell carcinoma involves the cells that have yet to become skin cells, right? Because they're in the basilar area. Whereas squamous cell carcinoma is starting to invade the cells that are keratinocytes because they eventually become squamous, don't they? Right? As they work their way up apically, right? Because your skin is, right? Remember? Right. It's if it's not simple, it is. If it's one layer, it's simple. If it's more than one layer, it is. Do you? Look it up. But as it gets to the top, it becomes more squamous in shape, right? Okay. So it's a tumor of the epidermal keratinocytes that occurs most frequently in light-skinned individuals. And of course, again, it's sun damage. So we're looking at ears, face, lips, and mouth. Less risk for darker skin, but still you can have some risk with lower extremities. Head, neck, scalp, and areas where they're not usually exposed to UV rays. So dark-skinned people who have, you know, arms and that are relatively always exposed, not likely. Us, on the other hand, because, you know, it's cooler here, we more frequently have this area more exposed to sun, you know, at any given time. This is our common area. And then those with darker skin, which may have, you know, more commonly covered areas, and then uncover them during the summer months, for example, they have a larger risk for it. Squamous cell carcinoma in situ refers to tumors that are usually confined to the epidermis, but may extend in the dermis, but they're just right in that area. Remember, in situ means right in that area. Invasive squamous cell carcinoma is more aggressive and can go down deeper into tissues, all the way down into bone. Basal cell carcinoma finds metastases rare, but squamous cell carcinoma has the potential to metastasize. So the previous one, basal cell, kind of hangs out where it is, whereas squamous cell carcinoma has the potential to spread around and go to other areas of the body and invade other areas. basically, we're seeing a rise in the squamous cell carcinoma, and it represents about 20 to 50% of all cancers. So it's not uncommon. It's somewhat common. UV radiation exposure, especially in childhood, is the most significant risk factor. Age and immunosuppression are also risk factors. So, you know, if someone's on medications because they've had an organ transplant, they have a higher risk of getting squamous cell carcinoma. So what happens is a metastasis for squamous cell carcinoma is about 4%, and more risk factors equals greater chance of metastasis, such as immunosuppression. Cellular damage due to UV radiation and resulting cellular mutations and protein dysregulation is the most significant cause of skin cancer. So whether it's basal cell carcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma, it's all about what damage the UV rays do to the DNA in the cell and all that kind of stuff. This also disrupts the tumor suppressor genes and the normal process of apoptosis. What we're saying is, because what we learned earlier, it is the UV rays disrupts the tumor suppressor genes. And remember, if you stop tumor suppressor genes, then your oncogenes start taking over and you have the potential of creating tumors, right? The other thing is, you've got apoptosis, which is normal cell death at a certain rate. And again, it disrupts that, and cells live longer than they should. And that also increases the potential for mutation and the growth of tumors. UVB and UVA have effect on the cutaneous immune system as well. So we have to, you know, that's why sunscreen is so important. So we can see it here. This is squamous cell carcinoma that we can see here, right? Sort of working that more keratinocyte area, whereas the basal cell carcinoma was affecting cells that are at the base. A large majority of squamous cell tumors occur in the head and neck region. The thing is, these lesions can be more difficult to characterize than basal cell carcinoma tumors because they're more poorly defined as compared to the basal cell. So basal cell carcinoma has a very defined border around it, whereas squamous cell carcinoma, the edges aren't quite as defined. They can kind of spread out and be a little more irregular. A squamous cell tumor can manifest as an ulcer. It can also manifest as a flat red area or a cutaneous horn or an indurated plaque or a nodule. So you can have variations in it. So this is, you know, it's not up to us to be able to diagnose this. It's more up to us to recognize if something odd is in the skin and then refer to the appropriate physician, family physician, to then have it looked at by the appropriate specialist to find out what it is or it is not. It may be red to flesh colored and surrounded by scaly tissue as well. Lesions on unexposed skin tend to be more invasive and more likely to metastasize except lip and ear. So if you find it in areas which aren't traditionally exposed to UV rays, that's likely a cancer you need to be really concerned with because there's a higher probability of metastasizing elsewhere in the body. The metastasis can occur to the regional lymph nodes, of course, and then from there it can go everywhere in the body. Size, shape, location, and invasiveness, condition of underlying tissue help determine the treatment. Okay? And I think I'll leave it at that, then we'll do melanoma next week. You're okay with that? Okay. Thanks for hanging around. They're all going to find out and go,